A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You felt 40 degrees in the shade. You probably never felt 57. Daniel wants to know why. He wrote in with a whole stack of questions. Why 40 plus is routine, but 50 plus is vanishingly rare. Why the planet seems to have a temperature speed limit, and whether there's an actual survivability threshold where heat stops being uncomfortable and starts being lethal even for healthy people. He points out that car thermometers lie constantly, that the Death Valley record from 1913 sits at nearly 57 degrees, and nothing has ever officially crossed 60, and that heat waves reliably spike mortality, especially for older people and diabetics. So we've got a physics question, a physiology question, and a public health question, all wrapped around the same number on a thermometer.
And the number most people think they know is wrong. That 1913 Death Valley reading, 56.7 Celsius, 134 Fahrenheit, is under active review right now. The American Meteorological Society published an article in late 2025 questioning whether it should be decertified entirely. The instrumentation was questionable. There was a sandstorm that may have contaminated the readings, and the observer who recorded it had a pattern of, let's call it, enthusiastic reporting.
Enthusiastic reporting. I'm going to remember that phrase.
The point is, if that record falls, the new official maximum drops to 54 degrees, recorded in Death Valley in 2020 and 2021, and 53.9 in Kuwait and Pakistan. Suddenly, 60 degrees isn't just unobserved, it's almost physically impossible given how the atmosphere works. And that's where the real story starts.
So let's start with the physics. Why does the atmosphere stall out? 40 degrees is common near the Dead Sea. I felt it, you felt it, it's unpleasant, but unremarkable. 50 is a once-in-a-generation event. 60 has never happened. What's the ceiling made of?
It's an energy balance problem. The atmosphere heats up because the ground absorbs solar radiation and re-radiates it as infrared. The air near the surface warms, rises, and convection carries heat upward. At the same time, any moisture in the soil or vegetation evaporates, and that phase change pulls enormous amounts of heat out of the system. You've got radiation coming in, radiation going out, convection shunting heat upward, and evaporation acting as a giant air conditioner. Those four processes set a thermodynamic speed limit.
And that limit is somewhere around 54 degrees.
Roughly. The math isn't a single clean number. It depends on latitude, surface type, atmospheric pressure, moisture content. But the theoretical maximum surface temperature on Earth, given our solar input and atmospheric composition, clusters around 54 degrees Celsius. You can push slightly higher in a perfect setup. A deep desert basin below sea level, bone-dry air, no vegetation, intense high-pressure system sitting overhead for days. And that's exactly what Death Valley is. It's below sea level, surrounded by mountains, and it acts like a solar oven. Even then, the highest credible readings top out at 54.
Which makes the 1913 number, 56.7, genuinely suspicious.
It does. The 2025 AMS analysis points out several problems. The thermometer used was a standard mercury maximum thermometer, but the observer at Furnace Creek that day noted a sandstorm had passed through. Sand and dust can coat the instrument housing, trap heat, and produce readings several degrees above true air temperature. The same observer had recorded other implausible highs earlier that summer that didn't match any surrounding station. And the weather pattern that day doesn't support a reading nearly 3 degrees above anything recorded before or since.
So you've got a dubious instrument, a sandstorm, and a guy whose notebook reads like he was gunning for the record.
I'm not saying he was gunning for it. But the AMS article is careful to note that the observer, a man named Oscar Denton, was under significant pressure to produce notable results for the fledgling weather station. The Furnace Creek station had been established partly to attract tourism. A world record was good for business.
Of course it was. You, of course.
If the record is decertified, the new official maximum becomes the 54 from 2020 and 2021, both from Death Valley, both using modern automated equipment with rigorous calibration, and 54 fits the physics. It's right at the ceiling of what the energy balance allows.
Let me push on that ceiling for a second. The global average surface temperature is about 15 degrees. 50 degrees is a 35-degree anomaly. What has to line up to produce a 35-degree departure from average?
You need a confluence of factors that almost never occur together. First, you need a subtropical desert basin, low elevation, because the air compresses and warms as it descends, and being below sea level gives you a thicker column of atmosphere to trap heat. Death Valley is 86 meters below sea level. Second, you need absolutely dry air. No moisture means no evaporative cooling, and water vapor is a greenhouse gas, but dry air actually heats faster in direct sunlight because there's nothing absorbing and redistributing the energy. Third, you need a persistent high-pressure system, a ridge that sits over the region for days, suppressing cloud formation and preventing any cooler air from moving in. Fourth, you need the right surface, bare rock or dry soil with low albedo, something that absorbs nearly all the solar radiation and re-radiates it as heat.
Low albedo meaning dark, non-reflective.
Right. Fresh snow has an albedo of about 0.9. It reflects 90% of incoming solar radiation. Dark desert rock has an albedo of 0.2 or lower. It absorbs 80% or more. And when you've got all four of those factors lined up, the surface temperature can climb toward 50 degrees. But here's the thing, even then, the atmosphere fights back. As the surface heats, it radiates more infrared. Radiation scales with the fourth power of temperature. A surface at 50 Celsius radiates far more energy back to space than one at 20. The hotter it gets, the faster it loses heat. That's the negative feedback that creates the ceiling.
So it's a system that accelerates its own breaking.
Every degree above about 45 requires an exponentially larger energy input to sustain. You're fighting the fourth power law. That's why 40 is routine and 50 is extraordinary. The energy required to push from 45 to 50 isn't just 25% more. It's a fundamentally different regime.
Which brings us to car thermometers.
I knew you were going there.
Because everyone has seen their dashboard read 55 or 60 and thought, well, there it is. The record's nonsense. Daniel mentioned it explicitly. What's actually happening?
Car thermometers measure air temperature near the road surface, typically from a sensor mounted behind the front grille or under the side mirror. The road surface, asphalt, absorbs solar radiation and can reach temperatures of 65 to 80 degrees Celsius in direct sun. The air immediately above the asphalt is heated by conduction and radiation from the road, not by the ambient air mass. Plus, the car itself is a heat source, the engine, the exhaust, the dark body panels. The sensor is sitting in a microclimate that's 10 to 15 degrees hotter than the true air temperature measured by a properly sighted weather station.
A properly sighted weather station meaning what, exactly?
A Stevenson screen, a white louvered box mounted at 125 to 2 meters above a grass surface, with free airflow on all sides. The louvers block direct solar radiation but allow wind to pass through. The thermometer inside is measuring the temperature of the free air, not the temperature of a superheated surface. That's the standard. Every official record on Earth comes from an instrument in a Stevenson screen or an equivalent modern automated system. Your car's sensor is in none of those things.
So when someone's dashboard says 60 degrees, the real air temperature might be 46.
Easily. I've seen a 15-degree discrepancy myself, driving through the Jordan Valley in August. Dashboard said 52. The nearest weather station reported 38. And that's not a broken sensor, that's physics. The asphalt was hot, the car was hot, and the sensor was reading the air in that specific 6-inch pocket behind the grill.
You know what I love about this? It's the same error every time and nobody learns. Every summer, social media fills up with dashboard photos and someone saying the official records are fake.
The records are fine. The dashboard is lying. And the distinction matters because when we talk about survivability thresholds, we're talking about the true air temperature and the humidity that comes with it, not what your Kia thinks it is.
All right, let's move to the body. What actually kills people in a heat wave?
It's rarely heat stroke. Heat stroke is the dramatic one. Core temperature above 40 degrees, confusion, loss of consciousness, the body's thermoregulation completely collapses. But that's a small fraction of heat wave deaths. The majority are cardiovascular.
Explain that mechanism.
When your core temperature rises, your body does two things. It dilates blood vessels near the skin, vasodilation, to shunt warm blood to the surface where it can radiate heat, and it activates sweat glands. Both of those processes require the heart to work much harder. Cardiac output can increase by 4 or 5 times during severe heat stress. For a healthy 25-year-old, that's uncomfortable but manageable. For a 75-year-old with even mild coronary artery disease, that increased cardiac demand can trigger a myocardial infarction. The heart simply can't keep up with the demand for increased blood flow.
So the heat doesn't cook the person. The heat makes the heart work until it fails.
That's the mechanism for most heat wave deaths, yes. The second big category is renal failure. Sweating pulls water and electrolytes out of the blood. If you're not replacing those fast enough, blood volume drops, the kidneys receive less flow, and in severe cases, you get acute kidney injury. Older adults often have reduced thirst sensation. They don't feel thirsty until they're already significantly dehydrated, and many common medications make it worse. Diuretics for blood pressure reduce blood volume further. Beta blockers limit the heart's ability to increase output. Some antidepressants impair sweat response.
And diabetes specifically. Daniel asked about that. Why are diabetics so vulnerable?
Two reasons. Diabetic neuropathy damages the small nerve fibers that control sweat gland activation and blood vessel dilation. A diabetic person may have impaired sweating. They literally can't cool themselves as effectively. Second, diabetes damages blood vessels throughout the body, including the microvasculature in the skin that handles heat exchange. The combination means they both generate more internal heat from metabolic dysfunction and have a harder time shedding it. Add in the fact that diabetes often comes with obesity, which adds insulation and increases metabolic heat production, and you've got a perfect storm.
I'm remembering something you said once about heat index assumptions.
The heat index, the feels-like temperature, assumes a standard person in the shade with a light breeze. It's calculated for a healthy adult of average height and weight, wearing light clothing, walking at about 1.4 meters per second. It doesn't account for direct sun exposure, which can add 8 to 10 degrees to the apparent temperature. It doesn't account for higher body mass, or age, or medication use, or any of the chronic conditions that change thermoregulation. It's a useful public communication tool, but it's calibrated for the easiest case, not the hardest.
So the official heat index might say 42 degrees, and a diabetic 70-year-old in direct sun is experiencing something closer to a physiological load of 50 plus.
And that's before we even get to humidity, which is where the wet bulb temperature comes in.
Define wet bulb for the conversation.
Take a standard thermometer, wrap the bulb in a wet cloth, and swing it through the air or put it in front of a fan. As water evaporates from the cloth, it cools the thermometer. That's evaporative cooling. Same thing sweat does for your skin. The wet bulb temperature is the lowest temperature that evaporative cooling can achieve under current conditions. If the air is dry, evaporation is rapid and the wet bulb is much lower than the dry bulb, the regular air temperature. If the air is saturated, 100% humidity, no evaporation occurs, and the wet bulb equals the dry bulb.
And this matters because sweat works the same way.
Your skin is the wet cloth. If the wet bulb temperature exceeds 35 degrees Celsius, sweat can't evaporate fast enough to cool you, regardless of how much you produce. You just drip. And if you can't shed metabolic heat, your core temperature rises inexorably. At a wet bulb of 35, a healthy young adult at rest will reach a core temperature of 40 degrees, the threshold for heat stroke, within about 6 hours.
That's the theoretical survivability limit Daniel was asking about.
It is, and it's important to say 35 wet bulb is the absolute limit for a healthy person at rest, in the shade with unlimited drinking water. Any activity, any sun exposure, any health condition, and the limit drops. At a wet bulb of 32, which is about 40 degrees Celsius at 50% humidity, or 35 degrees at 70%, a healthy person doing moderate outdoor work is in serious trouble within a couple of hours.
Has anywhere on Earth actually hit a wet bulb of 35?
Not sustained. There have been brief excursions, a few hours, recorded in parts of the Persian Gulf and the Indus Valley in Pakistan. A weather station in Jacobabad, Pakistan has come close multiple times. The Persian Gulf, because it's a shallow, warm body of water, produces extremely high humidity combined with air temperatures in the high 40s. That combination pushes wet bulb into the 33-34 range. but a sustained 35-6 hours or more hasn't been documented yet.
Yet?
Yet. And that's where the climate trajectory gets alarming. There's research projecting that parts of South Asia and the Middle East could regularly exceed wet bulb 30 by 2050 and approach 35 during extreme events. That shifts heat from dangerous for vulnerable people to dangerous for everyone. When you can't be outside for more than an hour without risking heat stroke, you can't do outdoor labor, you can't farm, you can't do construction. The economic and social implications are enormous before you even get to the mortality numbers.
Let's talk about those mortality numbers. Daniel mentioned the spike during heat waves.
The 2003 European heat wave killed approximately 70,000 people. Most were over 75. Many were in Paris, in upper floor apartments without air conditioning, during a heat wave that caught the continent unprepared. The 2022 European heat wave killed about 60,000. These aren't small numbers. Heat waves kill more people than floods, hurricanes, and tornadoes combined year after year. They're the deadliest weather phenomenon on Earth, and they don't leave dramatic footage, so they're undercovered.
70,000 deaths, and most people remember a photo of a dried-up river and a story about nuclear plants shutting down.
The river photo is the visual. The 70,000 deaths are a spreadsheet. It's a visibility problem. And it's getting worse because the population's most vulnerable to heat. Older adults, people with chronic conditions, are growing as a share of the total population in almost every country. More vulnerable people plus more frequent extreme heat equals a rising mortality curve that we're not really talking about.
What's the mechanism for the Paris deaths specifically? You mentioned upper floor apartments.
Urban heat island effect. Paris is a dense city with lots of stone and concrete, materials with high thermal mass that absorb heat during the day and release it at night. During the 2003 event, nighttime temperatures in Paris didn't drop below 25 degrees for over a week. Normally, the body gets a reprieve at night, core temperature drops, the cardiovascular system recovers. Without that nighttime cooling, the heat stress is cumulative. Each day you start from a slightly higher baseline. By day 4 or 5, people who were stable on day 1 are in crisis, and the upper floor apartments in old Parisian buildings. They're often directly under the roof, with no insulation, and they turn into convection ovens by late afternoon.
No air conditioning, no nighttime cooling, cumulative stress, and a population that wasn't acclimatized.
And a public health system that didn't recognize what was happening until the morgue started filling up. France's funeral directors ran out of space. They had to use refrigerated warehouses. It was a wake-up call that led to major changes in European heatwave preparedness. Early warning systems, cooling centers, check-in programs for elderly residents. The 2022 heat wave was comparable in intensity, but the death toll was lower, partly because those systems were in place. 60,000 is still catastrophic, but it'd have been worse without the reforms.
So the survivability question Daniel asked, is there a threshold for healthy people? The answer is yes, it's wet bulb 35, but the practical threshold for populations is much lower, and we're already crossing it regularly.
We're crossing the threshold for vulnerable populations every summer. The 2003 event had a maximum wet bulb around 28 in Paris. 28. That's 7 degrees below the theoretical limit for a healthy 20-year-old, and it still killed 70,000 people. The gap between theoretically survivable and actually survivable for a real population is enormous, and it's filled with chronic conditions, medications, poverty, isolation, and buildings that weren't designed for the heat they're now experiencing.
That's the part that keeps me up. We talk about the physics of 50-degree air as this fascinating ceiling, and it's fascinating, but the mortality starts well before you get anywhere near the record. 40 degrees with humidity and no nighttime cooling will do it.
And that's the public health reality. The number on the thermometer is only part of the story. The humidity, the duration, the nighttime minimum, the built environment, the age structure of the population, the prevalence of air conditioning, the strength of the social safety net, all of those determine how many people die. A 40-degree heat wave in Phoenix kills far fewer people than a 40-degree heat wave in Paris, because Phoenix is built for it. Every building has air conditioning. The infrastructure assumes extreme heat. Paris wasn't, and isn't, and retrofitting a 1,000-year-old city is slow and expensive.
All right. Before we move to Hilbert, let me try to pull these threads together. The atmosphere has a thermodynamic ceiling around 54 degrees, which is why 60 has never been recorded and probably never will be. 50 is rare because it requires a perfect alignment of geography, atmospheric pressure, and surface conditions. The 1913 Death Valley record is probably wrong, and if it falls, the new record will be 54, which fits the physics. Car thermometers aren't weather instruments, and their readings are inflated by 10 to 15 degrees. And the survivability threshold isn't a dry bulb number. It's wet bulb 35 for the absolute healthy young adult limit. But the real danger zone for population starts at wet bulb 28 to 30, and we're already hitting that.
That's the episode.
Not quite. Hilbert's been sitting at the board for 20 minutes, and I can see he's got something.
I used to take weather readings in the Mojave, 1984, 1985. We had a Stevenson screen at a remote station about 40 miles from Furnace Creek. Not a proper weather service installation. It was a contract job for a mining company. They wanted to know if they could work the crews through August.
What kind of temperatures were you seeing?
Official logbook had us at 51.2 on the hottest day. That's what got reported. What I saw on the uncalibrated max thermometer before I swapped it out was 58.
58 Celsius.
The screen had a warped louver. The ventilation was wrong. I wrote it up, they sent a replacement screen, and the readings dropped 4 degrees the next day. But the logbook only shows the calibrated numbers. The 58 never existed, officially.
So you're saying the station was reading high because of faulty equipment, and the real temperature was lower?
I'm saying the station was reading what it read. The equipment was faulty, so the number got adjusted down. That's how it works. But I've always wondered how many other stations did the same thing and nobody caught it. Or caught it and adjusted the other direction.
You think there are records out there that should be higher?
I think the difference between 54 and 57 is 3 degrees, and 3 degrees is well within the margin of a poorly sighted Stevenson screen, a lazy calibration schedule, or a supervisor who wants the numbers to match the regional average. I'm not saying the 1913 record is real. I'm saying the system is designed to smooth out outliers, and sometimes the outlier is the truth.
That's a fair point. Weather services do apply quality control algorithms that flag and adjust extreme readings. It's necessary because instruments fail, but it also means the true maximum might get erased.
I've still got the logbook from that station, the unofficial one. It's in a box in my garage next to my thermometers.
Your thermometers, plural.
I collect them. Mercury, alcohol, bimetallic, a few early digital ones from the 90s. Got about 40. The mercury ones are the best. You can feel the quality.
You have 40 thermometers in your garage.
42. I picked up two more at an estate sale in Barstow last spring. One of them's from a decommissioned weather station in Nevada. Still holds calibration within half a degree.
Do you test them?
Ice bath once a year. Boiling water at sea level. If they're off by more than half a degree, I adjust them or retire them to the display shelf.
The display shelf?
Anyway, the logbook's there if anyone wants to look at it. 58 degrees, July 1985. Unofficial, doesn't change anything, but I saw what I saw.
I'd like to see that logbook sometime.
It's not going anywhere.
The misconception that sticks with me from all of this is the idea that if your car dashboard says 55 degrees, the official records are wrong. They're not. Your car is measuring the temperature of a superheated microclimate 6 inches from asphalt that's been baking in the sun. The official record comes from a calibrated instrument in a ventilated white box on a grass field. Those two numbers have almost nothing to do with each other.
And the corollary, if the 1913 Death Valley record falls, it won't be because the planet got cooler, it'll be because we got better at measuring. The physics of the atmosphere hasn't changed. Our instruments have.
Which leaves the open question, if 54 is the real ceiling, and we're pushing more regions toward wet bulb thresholds that make outdoor life impossible for parts of the year, does the exact record even matter? The number that kills you isn't the one in the record book. It's the one on the thermometer outside your window, combined with the humidity, combined with whether you can get cool at night.
That's the thing to watch. Not whether Death Valley hits 57 again, but whether the Persian Gulf and the Indus Valley start seeing wet bulb 35, even briefly. Because once that happens, the question stops being academic.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, who apparently has a museum-grade thermometer collection in his garage and a logbook that might rewrite meteorological history. Or might not. He's not saying.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to send us your own questions about physics, physiology, or anything else that keeps you up at night, email the show at show@myweirdprobs.com.
We'll be back soon. Stay cool.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Props, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.